All right. Welcome, Canadian Association of Professional Speakers and Guests. We are very fortunate here to welcome you to this webinar. My name is Sanjay Nath, and I am have the absolute distinct privilege and pleasure of introducing this guest. His name is Seth Godin, and if you haven't heard of him and you've been living under a rock for the last 10 or 12 years, let me give you a very little bit about him. Often called a marketing guru or a thought leader. Last I checked, he was the author of 11 international bestsellers, translated to 35 different languages, and the list goes on and on. So welcome, Seth.
Thank you, Sanjay. It's good to talk to you.
Excellent. So basically, just to give you a bit of a demographic for most of our listeners here, they're small business owners, mom-and-pop shops primarily, one and two size organizations. So at the same time, though, we're servicing a lot of big business. So your question, as we ask questions, feel free to go wherever you want from a small sort of consultant standpoint or large business, however you feel, answer the question. So my first question for you is this is you are classified as many things, a speaker, an author, a marketing guru. How do you view yourself?
Well, anytime that the word guru is thrown around, I'm doing it tongue-in-cheek because I think that people who assert that they know the answers to questions have made a mistake, that all help is self-help, and I'm a teacher on a good day, but I am certainly never a guru, so I wear that very ironically. You know, I've been an entrepreneur. I am an entrepreneur. I started a pretty significant web company, sold it, and I run another one now. But mostly I'm known for noticing things, sometimes giving them names if they don't have names, but mostly shining a light and opening a door on places that people can go, because I think we are living in very revolutionary times, and too many of us are stuck fighting for the status quo instead of embracing the opportunity that's right here in front of us.
Perfect. Another thing that you're often associated with is innovative thinking. So question for you is, what are your inspirations for that innovation? Is it through reading books, client consulting? Where does it come from?
Well, I don't do any consulting, and the reason is I think that if someone pays me money to solve their problem, I better solve it. But most consultants can't because it has to be implemented by somebody else. So I don't want to take somebody's money. I'm happy to give free advice all day long and let them take what they find. I don't think that innovation is and insight is as scarce as some would like us to believe. I think that people are just afraid to say things out loud. And so all I do is write like I talk, and I don't get talker's block, and most people don't get talker's block. But what I seek to do is notice things that are going on in the outside world and out loud talk about what the implications of that might be, and then follow that down, see where it goes, and lay it out for people.
Perfect. And so in terms of writing or talking, as you said, how important is writing as a part of, as a function of your business?
Okay, so we have to be careful when we start talking about business, because if we're talking about business from the point of view of the industrial age, a business is something where you've invented something or built something or purchased something that becomes a tool that you use to extract money from the economy. A light bulb factory is a great business because after you've built it, you're going to get paid over and over and over again. And businesses are based on scarcity. There's a scarce number of places to buy light bulbs. I have them. They're cheaper than everybody else's. Come buy some. And this revolution we are living in now is not a revolution around scarcity. It's one about abundance, because we have an abundance of choices and an abundance of substitutes and an abundance of shelf space. And there's an infinite number of people you can follow online. And with all this noise and all this choice, we have to figure out how to choose which one we will trust and engage with. So I don't think of what I do in public as a business. I happen to be able to be fortunate enough to make money at it, but that's not why I do it. I think that if you instead view the world as disconnected people who are eager to be part of a tribe, eager to be part of a community, and you are able to create or amplify communities and then give people in that community a chance to connect with each other, to get the things that they're looking for, it turns out you can make a living doing that. But I don't think of it as I need to write because it's good for my business. I say to myself, I'm going to write this down because I think my tribe would appreciate it.
Excellent. Okay. And so you talked about this abundance, that we're living in a very abundant society, there's a lot of choices and such. Where do you think the shift happened? Or do you think that we've sort of essentially always been there? Were we ever living in a sort of a scarcity kind of mentality, and now we've shifted recently, or it's been like that for a while?
Oh, there's still an enormous amount of scarcity of physical items. You know, there's too many people who don't have enough to eat, too many people who don't have a roof over their head, too many people who wish they had one kind of car but don't have any kind of car at all. All of that is the symptoms of the growth of the industrial age. The abundance started kicking in, soon after the record industry realized that creating more titles made more choice made more money, when the top 40 became less important. You know, when I was growing up, and I wanted to be a professional speaker from the time I was 14, when I was growing up, you know, there was Forbes, Business Week, Fortune, and that was it. I mean, my dad got all three of them in his business, and I read them. But that was it. And the thought that I would be able to grow up and be a columnist for one of them was insane. That was unlikely. And, in fact, I never was. I was a columnist for Fast Company, and I've written columns for HBR. But better than a column, I have my own blog now. And almost everyone who's doing anything important in business thinking has their own blog with no editor, no one to tell them not to do it, and an unlimited amount of paper. That kind of abundance creates this maelstrom where it used to be that, you know, every week two important business books would be published. And now every 15 minutes two important business blogs are published. It's impossible to keep up, hence abundance.
Okay, that's great. And now I have to piggyback on a comment that you said, because given the audience, you wanted to be a professional speaker since the time you were 14. You know, most people want to be an athlete or a rock star. And can you comment?
You never saw me play hockey, Sanjay. I knew early on I was never going to be a professional athlete.
Okay. Now, again, when I was started doing research and asking some of the membership about this interview, people had a very very keen interest in, obviously, the publishing and the success you've had with book writing. One of the things that came up a lot was the physical size of your books, for the most part, are actually physically smaller. Yet Lynchpin was a more traditional size book. So that was a few people were wondering why the change, and what was the effect and results, or what was the thinking behind it?
Well, I mean, a little bit is like correlating the color of a politician's tie with how many votes they get. I mean, you might find a correlation, but it's not necessarily really call it causation. In my case, it was an intentional effort to make several of the books I've done small. The smallest are The Dip, We Were All Weird, and Poke the Box, because they were big ideas that didn't take very long to say out loud. And padding them would be silly, because then you would take away any chance they had of spreading. So the goal is to make a book as short as you possibly can, but no shorter. In the case of the four books I just published, one of them is 845 pages long and weighs 17 pounds, so I don't think anyone will ever again accuse me of only writing small books. But Fears for Vulnerable is 52 pages long, and no page has more than 100 words on it. So I'm not arguing that there is a right format. I'm saying that every idea probably has a format that resonates with it.
Okay. And also, again, someone specifically asked, they said you were quoted saying something to the effect of your readers have asked you to write smaller books, or I think the language has forced you to write smaller books. And so what you're saying, though, is it's a little bit of both. Some readers want the smaller, and that's why you're giving it, and that's all the thought requires, whereas, for example, this 845-page book, a little more elaborate, you're going a little deeper, obviously, and that's for that particular type of audience.
Well, I think it goes the other way, actually. There is no question, it's not just my readers, that what the public has said is they live in a 140-character world, and maybe, just maybe, they'll sit still for a 10-paragraph blog post. But, you know, if I write a good blog post, it'll be read by over 1 million people. And if I write a good book, it'll take me a year, and it'll be read by 300,000 people. Clearly, the return on investment, if I want to touch a lot of people, is to write the cheapest, lowest price thing I possibly can, because that's what people are consuming today. And that doesn't mean that that's all I'm going to write, because, in fact, I don't write to please the masses. I write because the idea demands it. And so the Icarus Deception is 245 or something pages or 200 pages long, not because that's the perfect size to sell a lot of copies, but because that's what I wanted to say.
Okay. So this 845-page book, when is it coming out?
Well, you can't buy it, I'm afraid.
Oh.
It was one of the prizes from the Kickstarter. It was a limited edition. It cost me hundreds of thousands of dollars just to ship the copies around the world. It's a collection of 350,000 words from my blog over the last 6 years, incredibly illustrated in full color, et cetera. And it's really heavy. It's 17 pounds, more than two babies put together. But I'm not going to sell it because I promised the Kickstarter people it was a limited edition. So what we did instead was we abridged a version that's only 650 pages, has no pictures, has no fancy type, and that book's in the store. It's called What You're Going to Do with This Duck.
Excellent.
Or That Duck. What You're Going to Do with That Duck.
Okay, which goes to sort of the next question here. In terms of how has the digital delivery system changed the world in terms of publishing?
Well, I want to just insert a small Hockey Night in Canada color play-by-play aside here for those of you who haven't stopped listening already, which is that what you'll notice, I think, about the people who are able to make a good living as a professional speaker is they're not trying to make a good living as a professional speaker. They're trying to make an impact. And when you follow the dummy's guide to what it takes to be a speaker and you check off all the boxes and you emulate the people who came before, then you're like a lot of other people. And if you're like a lot of other people, there's no scarcity, and so one speaker is just as good as another. And that the advice I give people who want to make it as a speaker is to go make it as something else first. Make the biggest impact you can. Make the biggest ruckus you're capable of. And then the speaking starts to take care of itself. Because what you want to be is the one and only, the irreplaceable, not the one who's very good at this. So I'm sorry. Now that I said that and got it off my chest, unsolicited advice for the alert listener, can you ask your question again?
No problem. How has digital delivery changed the book-selling world or the book?
Well, it's changed it in two huge ways. One, anyone who wants to can publish a book. Therefore, no scarcity. We're going to see a million books get published this year. If one of them disappears, no one's going to miss it. And since there's no scarcity, you can't act like you're holding your book hostage because people just go on to the next one, right? And the second thing that goes on is because there's infinite choice, prices go down. And once prices go down enough to, I don't know, free, then people say, well, I didn't pay for this. If it's no good after two pages, I'm going to go to the next one. And so we're seeing this requirement for holding on to the reader and taking them for a roller coaster ride if you actually want them to pitch in. You know, Tom Peters told me he estimates that 85% of the people who bought In Search of Excellence did not read it. And I would say that for many books, that number is now up to 95%, because buying a book gives you a feeling, it gives you social proof, it gets it off your chest, but finishing a book is still work, particularly for the masses of people who don't like to read.
And how does video change the game then?
So if you want to reach 20 million people or 40 million people, you don't even write a blog post, you make a video, because we've trained the masses that that's how to consume information. The problem with video is it's hard to find because you can't search it easily, and it's really expensive to make great video. Not expensive to make genuine video, authentic video, human video, video where you screw up. But if you want to make Gangnam Style, be prepared to spend $250,000 without knowing it's going to work.
And so if everyone is, in a sense, essentially yelling, because if you look at the value that's coming up before, you know, you had a printed book, and it was letters on a page. And now we have high-definition video, and we have instant dissemination and all this digital stuff. Everyone's yelling. How do you stand out?
Well, the question I think you need to ask yourself is, would they miss me if I wasn't here today. So, you know, the giant risk the NHL took when they locked out the players was that the fans might say, so, and just go about their lives. That if you're not missed, then you can't stand out when you're here. The way you stand out when you're here, then, is to generously contribute to the conversation as opposed to selfishly try to extract revenue. And you contribute to the conversation when you say something that some people aren't going to like, when you say something that stands out because it's not obvious.
What do you see are sort of the emerging trends in business that require some of these observations of you know, potentially unpopular observations coming?
Well, if a business is steady state and isn't changing, then there's nothing to say. But, for example, the North Pole is melting. There's a lot to say about how that's going to change the geopolitical/economic nature of what it is to make a product, move the product around, price the product, et cetera. And there isn't one obvious answer. So it's way easier to say something interesting about how the world changes when the North Pole melts in terms from a geopolitical standpoint than it is to say something interesting about the magic marker market, because the magic marker market isn't changing that much. And part of what we get to do as professional speakers is choose our topic. And the answer is not ask your audience what they want to hear, because the audience would have told Henry Ford, go make better buggy whips. The answer is to figure out what will make your audience uncomfortable enough that they're prepared to respond to it and take some action.
So this idea of you know, making people uncomfortable, it's obviously a very risky business, which is what innovation is all about, is taking those risks. So in your estimation, in your experience, what percentage of these breakthroughs, this innovation thinking, actually sticks?
Sticks to what?
Well, it's just in terms of, okay, so I'm going to go over there and I'm yelling, the world is round, or the world is flat, the world is flat. It's what you're saying. Your entire career is basically pointing out observations. And some of those observations are perceptions that people will buy into, and others, well, people are going to think you're nuts. And so my question is, because it's not necessarily right or wrong, it's, you know, thinking makes it so. When someone comes out with some crazy innovation, an idea, what makes it stick or not stick? Like, I mean, why the heck did the pet rock work and not the Chia Pet?
Okay, well, a couple things to answer here. The first thing is, please do not besmirch the Chia Pet. The Chia Pet worked really well. But leaving the Chia Pet aside.
My apologies.
It's very important not to try to look in the rearview mirror after the fact. The fact is, in 1972, something was going to work, and it just happened to be the Pet Rock. You can't then, after the fact, try to go backwards about why it worked. It's just something had to work, Gangnam Style. Something had to work. It's not that Gangnam Style was perfect. It's that it was in the right place at the right time. So I don't find that a productive analysis. I think the productive analysis is this. If you think about what happened in 1913, Marcel Duchamp put up a painting called Nude Descending a Staircase. And it was causing riots in New York City. Teddy Roosevelt, former president, wrote a long op-ed piece denouncing this painting. If he had drawn the painting 10 years earlier or 10 years later, it would not have mattered. But he drew the painting at the right time. It made the right statement. He saw the world as it was. That's the key. The key to making this sort of art, the art of being human and saying something that, in your words, sticks, is you are seeing accurately how people are, how the world is changing, what the opportunities are. Now, the key to understand is you will never please everyone. Nothing sticks to everyone. The goal should never be, how do I make sure that everyone in the audience gives me a 5 on the review? How do I get everyone in the audience to applaud at the end? You're not trying for everyone. That's not what public speaking is about or writing is about. You're trying for a few people. If you can make a few people uncomfortable enough to take action, and the key with uncomfortable does not mean angry, right? Zig Ziglar made people uncomfortable because Zig reminded us of our potential. And once you are reminded of your potential, you are uncomfortable until you take advantage of your potential. So the key here is, you know, I was talking to Zig about this, and I said, when I'm up there, and there's 800 people in the audience, and some guy in the third row, three seats over, falls asleep, all I can do is focus on that guy. And I'm bringing as much energy as I can, and I'm looking at him, and I'm willing him to wake up and get with the program. And Zig said to me, you know, he doesn't get the joke. He's not the person you're there for. That person sitting next to him, who flew across the country, who's totally engaged with your work, who's there for the right reason, talk to her. And it was transformative for me because I understood that a one-star review on Amazon doesn't matter, that someone who's criticizing me doesn't matter. They don't get the joke. Fine. I'm working with somebody else right now.
At the same time, though, too, we are human, and I mean, that's a very intellectual response to it, but there's an emotional component, too, going, frick, I got the 1 out of 10. Any advice or ideas on how to help make that transition?
Well, here's the thing, Sanjay. It's work, and we don't have to work with shovels and picks and stand out in the tundra digging an oil well. No, we do a different kind of work. We do the emotional labor of doing something we don't feel like. Right? We want to yell at somebody, but we don't. We want to ignore someone, and we don't. Right? That this work, our work, is the grown-up hard work of dealing with the fact that some people don't like what we do. And there's 100 ways that people could teach you how to do it better, but first we have to decide that it's important. And for me, my professional work, the hardest thing that I do is understanding that I am going to do stuff that might not work. That I wake up every morning, if it's a good day, and I say, good, today I get to do some stuff that might not work.
What are some of the barriers to reducing the likelihood of things not working? So what are some of those stumbling blocks that prevent us from noticing the observations or coming up with the next great idea or ruffling the feathers? Why don't we do it?
Yeah, I think the biggest obstacle of doing important work is the resistance, as Steve Pressfield calls it. And everyone listening to this should immediately go by Do the Work. And after you read Do the Work, go by The War of Art. And between the two of them, it'll take you 4 hours to read and cost you $20. And if you don't think it's worth it, I'll send you your money back. Because once you understand how your amygdala works and why you are sabotaging yourself and why even the most financially successful, socially accepted, embraced people on earth wrestle with it every day. You know, I mean, Carly Simon is still afraid to go on stage and sing a song. Once you understand what is at work, then you've got a fair shot at beating it.
Excellent. Thank you. In terms of, do you do a fair amount of work with large businesses? I wanted to ask, in terms of getting ideas to stick with them, what's the most effective way? Is it a top-down? Is it bottom-up? Is it a grassroots approach? What's been your most your experience with that?
Businesses don't decide anything. People do. And the question then should be asked is, which people are you choosing to work with? And in general, it doesn't make sense to work with people who are important. It makes sense to work with people who care. Because people who care are going to be there after you leave, and they can go beat up the people who are important. So for me, if I can find someone who cares, I want to talk to that person. I'm writing for that person. I am not writing ever for the CEO of HP, for Michael Dell at Dell. I've never written a blog post trying to reach Michael Dell at Dell because he's not listening. Right? But there are people who work for him who are listening. And if I can get them in alignment and give them words and give them concepts, then they can go figure out how to talk to Michael Dell.
Is there a correlation between those who care and position?
Over time, right? That in every organization, someone gets promoted to their level of incompetence. In every organization, there are bureaucrats and profit takers. But if there's no one in senior positions of influence who care, that won't last very long, except at the government level. But in organizations that have to compete, it doesn't take very long when there's no one at the top who cares before you end up running a company that becomes Western Union, right? Because enough people who don't care about the changes and their customers, then customers just leave.
And so what are some of the greatest leverage opportunities for individuals to care, to, you know, to shape society, to make a difference?
I think that I would ask the question, what are some of the smallest ways people can do it? That if you can get 10 people to eagerly look forward to the emails you send them, and if you can write those emails well enough that those 10 people want to forward them to their friends, then soon you will have 20 people. And once you have 20 people, and if your writing keeps getting better, then you'll have 50 people. And it won't be, I don't know, even 2 years before you have 10,000 people. And if you have 10,000 people who are looking forward to what you have to say and who trust you and are forwarding what you say to other people, then you will never, ever need to look for work again.
Do you actually have a systematic way of doing your writing? Do you do it, you know, every Monday morning from 10 to 11? Or what's the format for you?
No, I am sloppy and undisciplined because I've gotten away with it. And since I've gotten away with it, I haven't been forced to be better at turning it into a system. Someday I may have to, but so far I'm just winging it.
And now if you were giving advice to someone, what would you suggest?
Just write. Just keep writing. Don't stop writing. Write bad. Write worse. Keep writing. And if you are committed to writing, then your bad stuff will start diminishing and your good stuff will start showing up.
And how often do you, like right now, what you said you're sloppy, but in an average week, how often do you write?
10 or 20 times a day.
Oh, wow.
I mean, for every blog post people read, I've written 10.
And so what happens to the other 9?
They just go into the digital recycling bin.
Wow. Okay, that's great. You run a ridiculously successful blog. In fact, you have a bunch of blogs. And basically you're saying that it's just when you're writing your blog, do you actually have a specific demographic of a person you're writing for?
There's psychographics and there's demographics, Sanjay. And we used to care about demographics because we couldn't get to know anybody. So we said, give me 33-year-old women with pickup trucks in Vancouver with a gun rack on the back window, and I'll send something to them. But now we have psychographics, which tell us what people believe and how they act, as opposed to what they look like and what's on their census application and stuff. For me, I am writing for the people who choose to read my writing. And the people who have chosen since the Fast Company days to read my writing are impatient and driven and fascinated by what happens next. And so I don't have to say, to repeat myself, that the world is changing. I don't have to repeat that they better do something. What I do have to do is open doors for them and shine lights for them and encourage them to do that thing that they were holding back on.
And in terms of dissemination of the information, how does social media play? Are you leveraging that, or does it?
No, I don't use Twitter or Facebook. Other people do, and my job is to make it easy for them to do that.
Okay, so you offer ways of people sharing it via LinkedIn, Facebook, et cetera, et cetera?
Right. And, you know, if I could take the numbers off my blog, I would, because they change the way I write, and I wish I didn't see them, but I do. So I'll see how often a post is retweeted, and if I'm not careful, I will write stuff that I know will be retweeted because everyone likes to make numbers go up. So I don't pay attention to how many subscribers I have, and I don't track pass along, I don't track unsubscribes. I'm not in the business of managing my blog day to day. I'm in the business of reading mail from non-anonymous people, write me a note saying, I changed my life because you said this and I did that. And if I can make that happen, even once, every once in a while, I'll keep doing it.
What's your business setup look like? So is it you or do
yep.
you have help?
Just
do you have admin?
Just me.
Just you.
Yep.
So in terms of posting the blogs and the back end stuff, and you take care of all that?
Yep. I have a freelancer who built my website, and I can, you know, call up Brad if it breaks. But every word is written by me. It's all edited by me. When I write a book, there's a woman I've never met in Rochester who does some copy editing, because that way I don't have to worry about typos and stuff. You know, when I'm running my internet company, it's different. I don't know how to do that kind of stuff. So other people in other states are busy running Squidoo. But this is intentionally designed to be the highest leverage, lowest overhead thing I can imagine. But then I am not in the business of feeding the business. I'm just in the business of sharing my ideas.
Let's make a transition here, and let's talk a little more specifically about the speaking business. How much do you actually enjoy speaking? You mentioned, you know, since 14 you wanted to be a professional speaker. When did that sort of occur, and how much, you know, how much do you actually enjoy it?
So in 1995, when we were building Yoyodyne, we were competing with a whole bunch of companies in California like Yahoo, et cetera, and we could never have matched them with their promotional ability or their advertising budget. So what we did was we hired an inexpensive PR firm to do outreach to various internet conferences, and basically I was paying money to get in front of these conferences so that I could work for free. And I did lots and lots of these conferences. The first year I spoke at Internet World, I was ranked like number 1,100 on their speaker list in terms of results. And the third year I was their top-ranked speaker, because I started focusing on how could I be as generous as I could when I gave these talks.
Very generous in terms of material given?
Yes, in terms of, you know, what would happen is a lot of people would get to these events and say, wow, I'm here for free. I paid to be here. Here's an audience of my customers. How can I give them a sales pitch? And I gave no sales pitch, and I didn't do anything to try to get people to hire my company. I just described the world as I saw it. I talked about where I saw things were going. If I had competitors who were doing good stuff, I talked about their good stuff. Because the more generous I could be in leading the audience, the more likely it was the audience would trust me, and the more likely it was they trusted me, the more likely it would be that they would hire my firm. And then around 99, people started showing up and saying, you know, we'd like you to come to this conference. And I'd say, I can't, I'm busy. And then they said, well, we'll pay you. And that was when I became a professional speaker, in the sense that someone was paying me to go give a speech. And my biggest year I did, I think, 97 speeches in 11 countries. And when I was done with that, I was exhausted, and I didn't like the process. I hate the travel. I hate being treated like a criminal by TSA people and border guards and stuff like that. And I said to Tom Peters, you know, is this it? Is this what I'm supposed to do? Because he's, you know, he's given 120 speeches every year for the last, I don't know, 25 years. And he said, hey, this is what I do. I have no choice. And I decided I had a choice. So now I do about 30 or 40 a year. And the hour that I am on stage, I am totally loving every second of it. It is engaging and electric, and it's thrilling. I hate flying there. I hate, you know, wondering if I'm ever going to get another gig, because sometimes you go 2 months without one. But that's okay, because it's part of the deal, and it's a privileged life, and I would never complain about the fact that I get to do it. If I could do it without travel, it would be even better, which is why lately I've been booking my own theaters, particularly a couple in New York City, and I just say to my readers, come to New York if you want to hear me talk.
And how's that been for you? So you're getting into the public seminar business.
Right, and it's unbelievably straightforward today. It used to be really hard, right? I make one phone call, I get the theater, I write a blog post, I use Eventbrite, people come. I'm doing a gig in Boston on Wednesday for 350 people. And, you know, I have volunteers to take tickets at the door. I'll stand up, I'll give my speech, and then they'll say thanks and go home. It's not logistically difficult. The hard part is, can you connect with enough people who trust you enough that they'll come? And if that's the hard part, that takes a decade. But if you can invest in that, then controlling where you speak and how you speak isn't particularly challenging.
And when did you get into, you know, change the business model and start doing more of this public seminar stuff?
Probably about 3 years ago, and I've probably done about 20 of them, maybe 15. And it might have been a little bit more than 3 years ago, because I remember, actually, the first one I did was 2000, and I had a big old loft up here outside of New York City, and we had about 100 people come in a charity thing that we did. And it was the peak of the internet, and I'm embarrassed to tell you what these people paid for this charity event, but we raised about $500,000 for one day, which was really cool.
Right on. Your current revenue mix in terms of how you make money, where is, like percentage-wise, where do things come from? What's percentage of books versus speaking versus, you know, selling toothbrushes?
You know, I really honestly don't pay a lot of attention to that because it's a byproduct of this work that I love to do. And so, you know, if someone calls up and says, we're a charity, we're in New York City, and I believe in them, then I just go and I do it for free, not because there's going to be some upside, but because I love doing it and if I can share it. If someone says, come fly to South America for $15, I say, no, I'm not going to do that because I'm a professional and I hate getting on airplanes. And so it's this mix, and it keeps changing, and I don't measure it because if I measured it, I tried to make it go up, and I'm not trying to make it go up.
As it is, it's very organic. You just go with the flow.
Exactly.
What was the most impactful presentation you've ever given, and why?
Well, impactful for who?
For you.
I think that when I launched Lynchpin, I rented a theater in New York, and 600 or 700 people came, and it was a very scary book for me because it was a big leap from the kind of stuff that people expected from me. Shortly before I got on stage, three of my very best friends surprised me backstage, one of whom had flown from California, completely throwing me off my rhythm because it was 5 minutes before I went on stage. And then I just went out and I told the truth, and I told the truth the way I saw it. And people understood it, and I cried because it was very personal, and it meant a lot to me that people trusted me enough to come and that I was able to transmit this work to them in a way that I was so proud of. And it reminded me a lot of the time I met Zig backstage when we spent 3 hours together, because he taught me so much before that about what it meant to do this for a living. And to be able to share a stage with him 15 years later was just thrilling. And that was the day that I sort of said to myself, you know, I think I'm a professional speaker now.
Right on. Okay, so you obviously have a lot of followers. There's a lot of people that listen to and read Seth Godin. Who does Seth Godin listen to and read?
Everybody. It's not just an occupational hazard. It's the way my brain works. So, you know, hundreds of blogs a day, a couple books a day. There's just this stream of stuff that goes by. And, you know, on my blog, I've mentioned lots of those books. There are lots of people who I learn from and look up to. Today in the U.S. is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and my relationship to not just his words but his life and his example is fresh all the time. Pema Chodron, who lives in Nova Scotia, is just a brilliant thinker and connector about certain ways of thinking about spirituality. The summer camp where I used to work in Canada, I go up there every year to Algonquin Park, and to see the way Joanne Cates runs it and how she deals with the choices she has and her commitment to extinguishing bullying. You know, these are not obvious places for someone who speaks on marketing and revolution to look, but that's where I'm finding it.
What are you currently working on?
Other than talking to you right now?
Sure. Like, what's on the plate? What in the next year? There's
nothing on my plate. I just published 4 books. You're not allowed to ask me what I'm doing next.
You're taking a nap. Okay. And what's currently your biggest challenge?
The challenge is always what to do next. That there's this group of people who trust the work I'm doing, and I don't want to let them down.
You're not. What gives you the most concern in terms of trends, whether North American or global trends, that you see where you feel the world is heading? What concerns you the most?
The world is melting, and we are arrogantly ignoring the fact that the world is melting.
And are you talking? You're talking physically, right? Polarized.
Yep.
Gas. Okay.
There's no metaphor here, and you know, one day I'm going to have grandchildren, and then I'll have to apologize to them. If I knew how to use my marketing skills to shift this conversation, I would. I want them to start calling it atmosphere cancer, because that's what it is. And I think that anyone who understands labeling and branding would understand that atmosphere cancer is way more realistic than global warming, because people like globes and they like warm, but no one's in favor of atmosphere cancer. And the sooner that we start doing the right sort of treatment, the better chance we've got to make things last. But I'm getting more dubious. In terms of more mundane issues, I think that a large number of people do not realize the impact the connection revolution is having on us, and that the death of the industrial economy is just beginning. And I think we're going to see an enormous amount of dislocation that comes from that.
Now, I know you're not so much a financial guy, but what are your thoughts on the economy?
On the economy?
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, there's a cyclical recession, it's over, and then there's this permanent recession, and it's just not. You know, countries like Canada have done a good job of buoying themselves largely by extracting stuff from the ground, but being a big version of Kuwait is not a long-term strategy. I think that the day that we're going to see someone come into town, open a building, and say, I'm hiring 10,000 people with good jobs where you get told what to do all day and get paid middle-class wages, that's over. That's never going to happen again. And instead of wishing that we get back to those days, right, the days of all the people going to the steelworks in Hamilton, I think we have to understand that the asset today is not a better factory. It's that we gave every single person in Canada a connection to an economy with a billion people who are also connected. And they don't all want to hear from you, but if you build something that people do want to hear about, you can reach them for free as often as they are willing to hear from you. And that is an unbelievably momentous, positive, powerful development, and not very many people are taking advantage of it.
And on the flip side, then, what's what excites you? What's coming down the pipes in your vision of the future that you're excited about?
Well, other than what I just said, I would say that I think we are seeing a shift in which the most connected, most powerful people on Earth are discovering that respecting other people is a productive way to spend their time. And so we are shifting from this almost Stalinist view of owner and peon to a different view of tolerance and connection and mutual dignity that can't help but make the world better.
Right on. Last couple of questions here, and I know we've taken up a lot of your time. And we are extremely grateful that you're sharing your mind with us. You have a time machine, you go see yourself 20 years ago. What advice would you give yourself?
Well, the first half is I wouldn't change anything because I'm really glad to be who I am, and if I changed something, no matter how bad it was, I wouldn't end up being me.
Right, we've all seen Back to the Future.
Yeah, the second half of it is the one thing I needed to hear, how many years ago? 20 years ago, was it's all going to be okay. And I think that's true for most of us, but hearing that it's all going to be okay lets you take a little bit of the needy edge off and to be even more generous in the work you do.
Excellent. Thank you. Last question, extremely important, because you made a reference to it a couple times. And I don't know if you're being polite because it's a Canadian audience, but you mentioned hockey a couple times. Who's your team?
You know, we used to have seats 20 rows up in Buffalo where I grew up. And then one day I went to a fight and a hockey game broke out. And I said, if they're going to keep fighting like this, I'm not going to pay attention anymore. So they haven't gotten any of my attention since 1979. And one day if they just let Sidney Crosby play without someone trying to hurt him, I'll start playing, watching again. But I can't deal with the hooliganism and the people with no teeth and the blood and the fighting. So I don't have a team.
All right, that's fair. I apologize about the Chia Pet comment, and again, wanted to say thank you very much. Appreciate your insights and your time. If there's anything we can ever do for you, in terms of the CAPS community. We'd love to do that. Any last thoughts?
Well, I appreciate that. I hope you know I was kidding about the Chia Pet thing. I certainly
yeah.
don't have
oh, a, I totally
I certainly don't have a Chia Pet in that fight. I have no last thoughts other than one, which is this is the best time there's ever been to make a ruckus, and the only way you're going to make a ruckus is by doing something that matters as opposed to doing something that's popular.
Thank you very much, Seth Godin. If you did enjoy this, and I'm hoping you did, there's some wonderful, wonderful nuggets of information in there. Feel free to, you know, pass this on. I mean, that's how Seth works. He wants people, he wants to create enough value that you share it with your friends who share it with their friends, and you know, we make the world a better place. Again, thank you very much, and all the best to you.
Thanks, Sanjay. See you later.